The title of the session is Students in the Stacks, Building Capacity Through Academic Service Learning. It's a very, very exciting topic. I am Judit Szabó from Hungary. I'll be the chair of this session. We will have three lectures, two of them written by two authors. Both of them will come and speak to you. We organized the session so that after the presentations, you can directly ask the lecturer at about 10 minutes if you have many, many questions. Then follows the next lecturer. And at last, after all the five people finished, we will have a last circle, and you will have a second occasion to have questions, remarks, counter-arguments, discussion. Okay? That will be the organization. It's not so much used to, but yesterday it worked. The first presentation will be Angela Brinskele and Marie Cartier. They came from Los Angeles, the U.S. Angela is a professional photographer. She has been the director of communications of June L. Mazur Lesbian Archives for over 12 years. Marie Cartier is a scholar, visual performance artist, queer activist, poet, and theologian. She teaches at the California State University. And she just he published a book in December 2013. The title is Baby, You Are My Religion, Women, Gay Bars, and Theology Before Stonewall. It was published in a paperback and a hardback form also. So Angela and Marie, I call you to the floor.
Hi, thank you so much for our presentation, Empowering Youth Activism Through the Queer Archives in the Classroom. I'm Marie, and this is Angela. Do you want to move us ahead? Okay. We're going to talk about two specific classes that I worked with in terms of the Mazur. One is Women as Agents of Social Change, where students did primary interviews and created an archive folder that they donated to the Mazur. And the other one was a queer studies class, Los Angeles in Transit, Communities, Organizations, and Politics, where they volunteered 10-plus hours in an LGBTQ+ organization and then did a timeline project where they put their organization at the end, and they did timelines to get us to that, how that organization came to be through the creation of communities, then organizations, and then political change. So we're going to show you how those happen in terms of collaboration with the archives and some of the final projects that the students did. Do you want to say? So these are the points that we'll be looking at: the presentations, archiving, volunteering, and how the students did oral history and research.
This is an example of when they actually turn in their work at the end of the semester. We give them a box. This is not necessarily an archival box, but it's a box we bring to the class, and then every student, if they want to, can sign the top of the box, and we make sure that the box lid is always kept with the materials, even after it's processed and put in archival boxes later.
And you can see we tell them that this box is going to travel, so what would researchers want to see and be encouraged by when they actually look into this box? So you can see in the corner there, let this box make a beginning of many life-changing stories. Everything you can imagine is real. So the students get really excited that their work is going to be opened by other people. And here are some others, a close-up to all the females who were told their experiences wasn't valid. Stories are powerful. Hope these stories help. I hope you'll enjoy these stories. Let your voices be heard. Women are not the future. Women are the now. Our testimonies are valid. So students get very excited that they are creating something from their projects that will then go forward. And a lot of this is partnered with UCLA Special Collections.
Right, because Marie's the teacher of the class, it will go into her collection, which is now housed at UCLA Special Collections.
So the work goes under my umbrella as classes that I teach. So that's very exciting that I can provide that pathway for the students. So we're going to look specifically at the oral history projects where students donate archives first and then at the timeline projects. So this is the charge for the students. This is their final project paper, and we have copies of this if any professors would like to see how I facilitate this with an archive, an institutional archive. They actually do a permission form, and it's very important for me that they learn the difference between archives and libraries. Providing a deed of gift, getting permission, they create an hour interview that's time-coded in at least 10 points, and they do essays on, they do secondary research on their primary interview, and one of the big texts for this class is Bettina Epthecker's Tapestries of Life, and there's three core points in that. Art can tell the truth like nothing else can. Personal testimony is valid. Daily resistance is activism. So they find a point in their primary interview that illustrates each one of those points, and they do an essay on that, and then they provide photos. And Angela talks with them a lot about archiving the photos.
Yeah, they learn what a deed of gift is, which most people in the whole world don't know what a deed of gift looks like when you donate to an archive unless you've actually done it. And so these students learn the unknown part that a lot of people are kind of have some fear about, like what's that document look like. We have samples of our deed of gift, which we developed through UCLA, so we can give you a copy if you'd like one.
So this is the deed of gift. We have that, and that's also online at on the Mazur website.
Yeah, this is actually the oral history.
Oh, okay, this is the oral history.
The oral history form, and we make sure and tell them that if this doesn't get signed, they might as well not even do the interview.
Right.
Because then we can't do anything with it.
And if they use, and the translator form on the left is if they use a translator actually in the interview. So sometimes they may be interviewing somebody who speaks Farsi and they don't. If they have a translator in the room for the interview, that person signs a permission form. And sometimes they have ephemera. We'll show you an example of that, that will go with the interview into the box, and then they describe that property.
And this is a copy of the deed of gift, mm-hmm. which we can also give you a copy if you'd like.
So one really cool thing that Angela developed, when the students finish this class, we do a graduation ceremony for them. And we have done, we didn't say this, but we have done, Angela and I have facilitated the contribution of over 250 primary interview folders to the archive. I mean, somebody could do their PhD just this research. So when they donate to that sign box that you saw, we play the graduation, da 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 da, and we both sign this form, and we give it to them. And you can go ahead and read what it says.
Yeah, it's a certificate we actually created at the archives with a book cover that we have in the Mazur Lesbian Archives of a book from 1851, and it's called Heroines of History. And so a lot of people really like that image as well.
So when they come forward, we say thank you to donating for women's history.
For your donation to the Mazur Lesbian Archives, a vital lesbian and feminist community resource committed to sharing our history across generations, ethnicity, race, and personal belief system by collecting, preserving, and making available unique memorabilia in a safe and welcoming environment.
And we both shake their hands. So these are some of the final projects. You can see the deed of gift here. You can see the flash drive that has the interview. You can see here on the right the photo folder. You can see some examples of the secondary research they did using their primary research interview and looking at secondary materials and quoting their own primary material. And here's a folder expanded. And some ephemera that was donated with the folder when it went in.
And for the archives, it's really important to me to tell the students that most photos in archives have absolutely no information written on the back, so all these future people will be knowing to write on the back of their photos as much information as possible.
So this is the information they provide about the photos, who, where, when. And why was the photo taken, and who's in the photo. So that's information. If they have it, we have them provide that. And then these are some of the examples of how they would time code, so that if a researcher looks at the audio, they know where to cue it up.
Yeah, it's a specific time log. So I tell them, for example, I lived through the Northridge earthquake in 1971. So that would be something that if I was being interviewed, you would want to put on your time log, as mentioned in that oral history.
This is an example of the ephemera that students could do. So one thing we haven't talked about is that when students present their final performance, their final work, they do a creative response to the material. So they may do a poem based on the interview subject for the final. They may do a short story. They may do most of them do a monologue in the I voice of their informant. This woman did a monologue in the I voice of her mother being Iranian and dancing. And so she contributed the bracelets that she wore in the monologue and the monologue as well to her folder. At the Mazers, when we can, we bring the students to the Mazer for their final performance. My student is the one in the blue dress, and the woman that she interviewed is her mother, who is to her left. So my work is at the Mazer, it goes under my umbrella, but not everybody is a lesbian whose work, it's not just the June Mazer Lesbian Archives. Any woman who they interviewed can be welcomed into the archive.
That's really why it goes under her collection, because she's the lesbian who is... She's the lesbian who is, the reason for the donation.
Right, and so you can see sometimes students are so excited and parents are so excited. There's very few opportunities in the States anymore for parents and families to see their students present their work. So many times we have big family groups come to the June Mazer Lesbian Archives to see their students perform, and this is a large family that came, and the middle section is her creative project that she talked about. Here's some students creating a box, and the blonde on the right is now a permanent on your left with the bangs, is now employed at the archive, and she found out about the archives by volunteering through my class. So I tell my students that volunteering is an invitation to the party. Los Angeles is a big city, and many times they don't know how to get like their foot in the door, so archiving, doing the volunteer is a good way to do it.
You probably want to get
to the next class. This is celebration of the performances. And now we're going to go into the next class. Okay, so in this class, this queer studies class, they're going to do not, they're not giving an interview, they're volunteering their time. For this project, there's several things they have to do, but they have to create historical material that then documents how that institution where they did the volunteer hours came to be. So they use sources, they use pictures, they have to interview somebody. And you can see up there it says one below source. That is our special collections at California State University Northridge, the Vern and Ernie Below collection. So they do institutional archive sources and grassroots archive sources in this timeline.
And that archive at Cal State Northridge is all about sex.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. They also might donate their timeline and do a deed of gift. The students themselves do a big performance, and everybody is invited, and they create these posters in order to promote their event. So this is a student, Carrie Chen, and this is her timeline project, and we're going to pass it around, where she's creating a way to talk about how the June Mazer came to be in the community. The students are charged with going back before Stonewall. She's not going back yet, but she will be going back. But she's talking about Evelyn Hooker's research at UCLA in 1973 here. I don't know why she has 1992, but anyway. She's talking about how Evelyn Hooker interviewed gay men in bars in Los Angeles, and in 1973 the designation for homosexuality was removed from the American Psychological Association. So she's talking about the massacre at Pulse. She's talking about the ban on marriage. And the students must put themselves on the timeline. So they're in a queer studies class, which we do many field trips. We have the Mazur come in. We go to the Triangle Elder House, which is the first gay and lesbian elder community in the nation, and they meet gay elders. This is the first time they have met them. I have many students say, I didn't know gay elders existed. I'm like, how did you get here, boo-boo? So, so I have them put themselves taking a queer studies class on the timeline. So here she is, her volunteering. We also have ACT UP come in. I was a member of ACT UP. She interviewed Angela. And then where do we go from here? And she actually did a project presenting her timeline, saying, how do you see the movement in the future? What would you like to archive? I always ask my students that. If you could archive, what would you like to archive? And Angela asks them that too when she presents.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the most important things for me when I talk to students is to tell them, I always ask them, I say, the Mazur was a grassroots archive. Do you know what that means? And most of them never know what that means. And I like to see their faces when I tell them it means that three women in Oakland in 1981 thought there was a need in the community for this archive, so they started it. So you can do that too. And yeah. A lot of them, I can see their eyes kind of light up like,
oh, yeah. So these are the stacks from the Mazur on the left, or right, or wherever. It's another project. This is a student who did her project as Stonewall, and she turned over these stones to talk about her points. This was 30 bras, and they had their historical points inside the cups as supporting women.
A support system, yeah. They said.
There's another project. It's California. This student did a great project where she did a Monopoly board. And we see her here playing the Monopoly, and it's all about the Mazur. And so here we have a lesbian jail. Instead of going to jail, you have Monopoly, right, in Germany? Instead of going to regular jail, she goes to the women's jail in Los Angeles in the 50s. This student's sister was disconnected from her, and she did an archive box for her sister with things that illustrated what her sister had said to her. The bars mean more than just a drinking place. This is a student who did hers on Outfest, the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, and how it started. And she's doing interviews with Nancy Valverde. This student did Somos Familia Vaya, which is a project specifically for Latinx community, and she ended up doing a legislative trifold brochure about specific laws related to the Latinx community in the Valley, and she did it for them as her project. Beautiful project about pride. This student did a monologue. He worked at the One Archives, which some of you have heard talk about this weekend in LA, and he is a gay bartender in the 50s, and the bar gets raided, and he has to give the cash box to the police who come in, and he ends up being mad at one of the patrons because they don't know about gay history. So he is an actor in Los Angeles, and he was in my class, so his presentation was a monologue. This woman did a fortune-telling device with her time codes inside of it. More. These rainbows opened up, and the time was inside. Closets, closets, closets. More beautiful projects. Angela in our class. My students are excited. Oh, wait, go back one more. This student here, very low with the short haircut, she got an Outset Director Award from a film she made about a founding member of ACT UP for my class. More fabulous. Here's Angela and I in front of my department. These are the student outcomes. I'll read half it. Activism as community engagement. Three core APTHECA principles. Personal testimony is valid. Daily resistance is activism. I teach all my students every semester how to get arrested. I wasn't ACT UP. Art can tell the truth as nothing else can.
Where were you? Sorry.
Archiving is radical history making.
Story catching, libraries versus archives, because a lot of students think they're the same thing. Community building inside and outside the classroom.
And I will Angela and I did the photos, mostly Angela, and my wife, who is Brain Crops, did the PowerPoint for us, and we have 33 seconds left.
Thank you. Good job.
And I think we are up here for questions. We stand here?
Yes. Oh, okay. Thank you for this presentation. We are convinced that Maser is a well-organized archive, and you conduct very happy courses. First, please, questions, real questions. Some questions arise.
Go ahead.
It's just me. So I, Angela and Maria, I was wondering, I'm a bit of an insider, so I understand, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, for your courses, I noticed that it's a 300-level course at CSUN, and I was wondering if you can talk about what that means in terms of what kind of students are able to and attracted to taking those courses.
There isn't a prerequisite for the 300 classes, so I could get freshmen, sophomores, juniors, or seniors, or graduate students. 300 would normally be a class that a junior would take. Our classes in California are super impacted, so I know my 6 classes in the fall are already over-enrolled with a waiting list. I mean, so everybody, queer studies and women's studies is one of those fields that some people may come in and they have a huge body of knowledge already, and some people come in and they don't know what Stonewall is.
I'm also passing around a sheet I wanted to say that I give to students. It's an acid-free sheet, and we tell them to take it home and put something and start their archives, put something important to them in it, and that they can purchase them cheaply at Costco. You can buy for $12, 250 acid-free sheets. So we try to get them started on thinking archivally for the rest of their lives.
Other questions?
Sorry.
Are you picking or?
We have a volunteer.
In the middle, I think she was first. Oh, okay.
Bidigulais.
Yeah. Hi. I just wanted to ask you a bit about the time allocated. You said 10 hours, and I was wondering, do you find that is enough? I know as an archivist, we often get these students who like have to do a certain amount of hours, and sometimes it is a little annoying when it's a very small amount of hours like that because it's not really enough to engage with the students properly, and you know, you've just kind of explained everything, and then they're gone. I was just wondering how you came up with that amount and how it's worked.
A lot of the service learning classes have 40 hours, but that's all the classes. So the 10 hours for me is enough time for them to understand what an archive is, but they're still learning and doing a final project. So luckily with the Maser, often what they're doing is a very specific focused project, or helping with helping put on an event.
Yeah, there's a couple things we do. We actually have events every few months, not because we're an archive, we don't have to, but the community demands that we stay active with them. So we have events, and the students love to help at events, which is fantastic, because otherwise our board is working the whole event. But the most important thing is when they come and actually help in the archives and create a list of stuff in the boxes. I'm not using very archival terms here. Anyway, they do all different things in the archives, but what I make sure of is no matter how long they're there, they spend at least 1 hour researching something they're really interested in.
Yeah.
So I make sure they have a solid hour alone on whatever topic they're looking for, and I go find that for them. And they sit for an hour and actually look at something they're really interested in personally. And that usually really grabs them. We have a really big success rate of these students coming back later. I'm not saying 80%, but even 10 or 20% come back later when they're out of school and volunteer later on in their lives. So that's really valuable to me. And I think giving them that personal time to research something really personal to them that they're interested in makes all the difference.
Also, my students at Cal State University Northridge are often working full-time. They may have 2 jobs. Many of them are primary caretakers, primary translators for the people in their family. The Majority of dreamers in the U.S. go to California State University, Northridge. They often have undocumented people in their family. So for me, requiring them to do 10 hours is actually a huge amount to get them to free from their schedule to do that. It's often very difficult to manipulate their schedules to get them to free that amount of time. Many of them are moms. It's not a wealthy population at all.
Marie and Angela, thank you very much. I love the project. And I was thinking how we might, you know, apply something like that in a different geographical location, for example, my own city of Belfast. And there we don't have that many organizations and also fewer people who are out. Yeah. So there would probably be a kind of a temptation to try and have the students go and interview individuals, and then that raises its own issues about whether or not they're prepared for interviewing older LGBT people who've had maybe some traumatic experiences. So would you have any advice for how you would approach it?
Yes, I do, actually. We have 25% students who are food insecure at my school and 10% who are home insecure. So they can volunteer at a food bank. It's supposed to be LGBTQ, but Maslow's level of needs demands that I allow them to work at a food bank if that's, and also if their schedule will only allow them to do that.
Yeah.
We have two food banks and a food garden at our school, and our women's center maintains a food bank. During the election, they were allowed to volunteer their hours for the Democratic Party. As soon as Mike Pence was nominated as vice president, I allowed them to volunteer for the... he's the most anti-gay politician in our entire country. So I think I actually have dual citizenship with Ireland. So I think...
We do a collaboration.
Yeah, and, LGBT... Going to an organization that supports food distribution, et cetera, I know many of my students are hungry, and I'm extremely bothered and supportive of trying to remedy that. So I think having students go and find out how those organizations are LGBTQ sensitive and being an LGBTQ presence in those organizations is very valid for me and for my institution.
Yes? What do you do about oral history interviews where there might be interviewing people who've experienced trauma or violence, and these are students who maybe are not equipped to conduct those interviews? Is there do you do a screening process? Or
actually, we don't, and usually they're doing the oral history with somebody they know extremely well, like their mother.
Maybe.
But we also tell them that this person has the right to be anonymous.
Yes.
And so they cannot fill out anything on the other side of that sheet. The oral history person, the student, fills out everything no matter what. But the other side, that person
could end up being anonymous,
and half the time that really helps with the interview. But as far as taking care of the student in that way,
I can talk about it.
We just talk about that that's a possibility and give them a heads up.
I give them an... For my book, I interviewed 102 primary interviews about gay women from the 19 pre-Stonewall about their gay bar attendants. And my book is a model of how to do ethnography for the students, and I have cards about it here. But many of my interview subjects were talking about being raped by the police, and I was the first person they were telling about it. So I say to them, that interview, many of them, 80% of my students hear stories about domestic violence for the first time when they're doing their interviews. And we talk about that, and they have supportive text in my class. And this is why my classes are not 40 hours of volunteer service, because they have a lot of time to learn how to do an interview, to be the... We use a book called Story Catcher by Christina Baldwin that talks about how to create the container for a story. So they aren't going in untrained of how to do the interview. And the expectation that something may come up is prepared for them.
Yeah, that's actually the first thing we go over, is the whole details of doing an oral history and the things to be aware of at the beginning.
Other questions? Or is there time for more?
Okay. Yeah. The last question, okay.
I also work with students, but I'm doing intergenerational interviews, and we do like 6-week programs, but it's through photographic storytelling. And I noticed that you said that they didn't have a concept of what a senior LGBTQ person...
Many of them don't, yeah.
And I just did my first year of this, and it was actually unanticipated for me, and I had to change the structure of my course. And I just wondered how you cover that, knowing you've obviously got a very established course. Right. How you approach that in terms of making the students informed?
Well, they're reading my book, so they're reading about how I came into the community of interviewing elders. I also take them to Triangle Elder House, and I do a panel with people who are in my book, who are, I mean, Nancy Valverde was the second person to challenge the LAPD in order to wear masculine clothes so she could be a barber in the 40s and 50s, and she won. I mean, they meet people. I bring in founding members of ACT UP. So they meet elders. And when I got the course assignment 5 years ago, my first thing I knew was I was taking them to Triangle to meet elders. And many of them also become permanent volunteers at Triangle if they do their work there. And I knew that I was bringing in founding members of ACT UP. And so that's my... biggest thing is that they meet people who came before them, before they go out into the community.
Super.
I wanted to just say one more thing. I always ask the class at the end of the semester, how many people feel like the interviews they did changed their lives for the better? And a third of the class every semester, at least, raises their hands.
And we also ask if it changed their relationship with the informant. And most of them say yes. It changed how they viewed their mother, how they view their elders. So being able to catch a story changes everything about how you relate to other people. And that's part of why I focus the class on ethnographic testimony.
Thank you, Angela and Marie.
Thank you so much.
We had a presentation full of information.
Thank you.
We learned a lot. The next presentation will be held by Benno Gammel. He came from the Goldsmiths University, London. He just this year published a book in which was edited by Mark Seymour and Sean Brady. The title is From Sodomy Laws to Same-Sex Marriage, International Perspectives Since 1789. Benno's contribution has the title, Affecting Legal Change, How Laws Impacted Same-Sex Feelings and Relationships in West Germany Since the 50s. Benno is a DAAD Fachlektor, so German Academic Exchange Service Fachlektor in Queer History at Goldsmiths. So please hear his presentation.
Thank you very much, Judith, for the kind introduction. I was going to say thanks to the organizers, but I'm one of them. So I'm glad to be here. I'm looking forward to the discussion. Already enjoyed the first presentation, also looking forward to the presentation that comes after me. I mean, I also going to talk quite a bit about oral history because I think it's just so an exciting field if you think about educational projects. I also did myself a lot of oral histories for my project on homosexuality and emotional life. And from there, I moved on to Goldsmiths, where I'm doing the queer history MA program, the Center for Queer History, together with my colleague Justin Bangry, who unfortunately cannot be here today, but says hello. And Goldsmiths is a higher education institution. It's part of the University of London. For those of you who are familiar with London geography, it's in the southeast of London, around New Cross in Lewisham. I am working on queer history there, and together with my colleague Justin, we have just launched the center for queer history, and that's kind of, we are very proud of that. This, here you see me being kind of very delighted to see the new sign that says Center for Queer History. The course is running now, we're moving into the third year, but that center is fairly recent. What does it mean? Center means that we are kind of, together with other people from other departments, media and communications and other departments, we kind of come together, and kind of being called a center now grants us even more visibility within the college and beyond the college. And we even have, it's not the whole house, but a fair share of a house, which is, as you can see, 35 Laurie Grove. In New Cross. So there is also, there is a thing about the space and that sign being on the street, students passing by, other people passing by, saying, oh, Center for Queer History, what is that, why is that? And I think that in itself already has a certain value, but also the things that happen in that house, which I will talk more about. So that's where we are. 35 Laurie Grove. If you happen to be in London, drop me a line, come by for a visit, and I'll show you around. And within that center, we organize events, we have visiting researchers, and of course, we also do have an online presence on the web and on Twitter and on Facebook. And on the website, you find information about our events. You also find, if you're interested, recordings of past lectures and discussions in our Queer History podcast, and many other links and information that you might want to have a look at. So here is what I'm going to talk about in the next 50 minutes or so. I'm quickly going to talk you through the MA program in Queer History, just to give you an idea. What do you do if you want to become an MA in Queer History? Our event series, and then mostly I'm going to talk about the Archive for Queer Life Stories. That's the archive we are in the process of establishing, and I thought kind of for the arms conference that might be the most interesting bit. So there we go, the MA for Queer History. Our first graduates came out last year. So in December we had the graduations. I'm a German academic, so I'm not used to these kind of graduation ceremonies, but I went there, and first time in my life I had the full academic gear. And I mean, and they were, they were the first MAs in Queer History in the world. So I mean, it was a very special event. And I mean, the thing is, I say it's the first MA in Queer History in the universe. Of course, there is queer studies, but kind of what is special maybe about us is kind of the combination of queer and history. Some of you might know that history tends to be a conservative discipline. But there is also what we kind of highlight is kind of the choice of empirical research, going to archives, finding things that you did not expect, that kind of work from a queer perspective. So that's kind of, I would say, makes, you know, what is kind of special or maybe interesting, exciting about the work we do. So calling ourselves queer historians does not mean that we do not take on board all the intricacies that queer theory makes us think about, all the kind of interesting stuff that comes up within queer studies. Actually, we do a lot of, especially with queer temporalities, of course. I mean, for history, that's the most interesting bit. But we also really have a strong emphasis on finding sources in archives, on doing oral history interviews, and then on analyzing these primary materials, and time again, enjoy being surprised by what you find in them. So what we teach, just to give you a brief overview, there is kind of the main module is called Explorations and Debates in Queer History. Then there is a module on research skills, where we, among other things, take students to different archives. I mean, maybe in that respect, London is different from Belfast, so there's no shortage of places where you can go and search for queer history materials in a variety of archives. So we take our students there. Then there is a module that's it's called Let's Go Places, Queer History Through a Spatial Lens, Queer Public History. I'll talk more about public history. That's another module. Global Queer Subjectivities. But then, of course, our students can also do modules in other departments, other history modules, actually across the University of London, so also in other colleges of London. So we teach that, and then kind of we have extracurricular queer history events. Last year, our annual queer history lecture was done by Dan Healy on a homophobic present and the queer past. Do post-Soviet queers need history? Fits again, I think, quite nicely with things that are discussed here at the conference as well. And the year before, Alison Oram gave our annual lecture on Outing Octavia, Transforming Queer Heritage in Britain. And beyond those kind of big annual lectures, we do a series of talks, screenings. We had a screening of Anders aus die Anderen, the film that was shot here in Berlin with Magnus Hirschfeld in 1919. We had that with live music. We have panel debates and all kinds of things, lunch conversations. And then we also do annual international queer history workshops. They're just called Queer History New Research. They're kind of really to bring everybody who is doing PhD or whatever kind of MA research in queer history to bring those people together and make them talk to one another. And we found out that that is really important, but often people are kind of disconnected, and that kind of low-key possibility to talk about what you do in your research is, but many people really value that. So that's the events we are doing. Just to highlight one that happened last year, we did an event, or actually students of us, some of our students organized that. It was a student-led event with queer refugees where we had Ice and Fire, an organization that kind of performs queer refugee narratives. And after that, we also had a discussion with that with different organizations that work with queer refugees. So just to give you an idea of the kind of events we organized. You might already have noticed that queer public history is particularly important. So all kinds of queer history that engage with the public and that try to have an impact on the public. The political and societal impact of what we do is very important for us. It's also important for us because we want to make sure that there is no disconnect between that kind of more academic college setting within which we move and the activist field of queer history. We really try to keep those fields together. One of the ways we do that is the annual Queer History Fair, where we invite our colleagues and friends from organizations like Ducky Queer Heritage, from the Bishopsgate Institute. I already mentioned that there is no shortage in London of such organizations. The Queerseum, the London Metropolitan Archives, the Victoria and Albert Museum, the LGBT group there. And, you know, there's more and more, and we invite them to college, and they present their work. Our students get into discussions with them. It's also a public event, and that's one of the ways in which we kind of try to maintain that connection between the academic and the activist, more academic, more activist. But it's also important for us because it really eases the way, as you already mentioned, for our students into their working lives. Right? It's exactly these kind of contacts, these volunteering opportunities. There is also a module that has placements, so then the students work in the archives. For example, that was not a placement with an archive, but with a charity. Two of our students had a placement with a charity working with elderly LGBT citizens who suffer from dementia. And our students searched for LGBT-specific images and memorabilia from the 70s and 80s who could then be used in games geared at strengthening the memory of the clients. So the charity is trying to make an offer to LGBT elderly people suffering from dementia, and our students could help in kind of, you know, they might need specific triggers because they have specific experiences, and that's exactly what they did. So they looked for images and kind of produced that kind of game that could then be played by those clients. The other project that I've already mentioned, that we think that oral history is particularly fruitful for what we do, so we are establishing the Archive for Queer Life Stories. That archive will also house a collection of books and other documents, but these are still ongoing negotiations, so I'm not going to say anything about it. But the second main pillar is going to be an archive of oral histories. We hope to collect further material also around these oral histories like you do, so kind of if people have photo albums, if they have any kind of diaries, of course, so it's the oral narrative, but also these kind of additional materials. And we encourage our students to do oral history projects and develop the Archive for Queer Life Stories so that the students, once they do oral history projects, afterwards they can deposit their interviews with that archive. So the idea is not that there is kind of an organized model they follow, but they do their individual projects on what they are interested in, they do interviews for that, and then those interviews can end up in the archive and then be used by other researchers and students for further research. So making interviews from different oral history research projects available to other researchers and students is absolutely crucial for us, and I think that is also a general problem or issue. How do you do that? How do you make interviews available and searchable? How do you enable researchers who are interested in issues around HIV and AIDS to find maybe that one passage in an interview that stems from a project about queer parents that also talks about HIV and AIDS? So these are kind of the questions we are very much thinking about that. Was that 5 minutes? Ah, wow, all right. And I already think I'm going fast, but okay. And this is important for many reasons. I think there is still far too many interviews sitting on the shelves of some researcher, and they are not accessible and they are not searchable. So this is kind of a broader issue, and I'm happy to discuss that further with you. So how can one make sure that those interviews are then also used further by other projects? I think it's very important to have a document that allows you to reconstruct the original context within which the interview was done. So that's why we ask students to make research notes. What happened at the interview? Why did you do it? So that if somebody later on goes back to the interview, knows what was the original intention of the interviewer who did the project in the first place. Coming back to the question about preparing students for interviews, we also have it's called an ethics review process through which they go, so they get a number of questions and they are asked to think, and that includes kind of, is there potential harm for yourself? What do you do if a traumatic experience comes up in a interview situation? And then of course we discuss about that with them as well, and make sure that, you know, you can never exclude the possibility, but it should be not likely that it happens, and if it happens, that they are prepared, that they know, you know, they can advise their interviewees, you can call this number, you can go to this organization if you need further help, and that they also know for themselves where they can go and where they can find further help should they need it. So this interview is very early stages. I personally have done one interview so far for this archive. I'm going to spare you the very interesting details about that interview. But I wanted to talk more about kind of how we frame, how we organize that archive, how we try to make it accessible. We do agreement forms and recording agreements. All our students do this. If we ourselves do interviews, we do that as well for the interviewees. So we have that in the archive. We would have the audio file. We would have the research notes I already mentioned, and the additional material, photo albums and diaries, or photographs of those albums and diaries. So we have all that. Just a quick note on the recording agreement, in case you're interested. We ask our interviewees... We use a Creative Commons license. It's called Attribution Non-Commercial 4.0 International License, in case anybody of you has wondering about it, kind of to deal with the copyright issue. So they agree for people who use their material, their narrative for non-commercial purposes, to use it freely as long as they acknowledge from whom the interview originated. And in technical terms, we plan... I'm just bringing this up because I would like to hear whether anybody had experience with similar technical tools already. We plan to use the Oral History Metadata Synchronizer, which is kind of, you have the interview, you have the recording, audio or video, you kind of come up with a contents page, you do short summaries of each segment, so you can search those summaries, and the good thing is when you have found a specific segment, you can click on that and that takes you directly to that moment in the recording. That's basically what that tool does, and I think that could be really helpful. I think it's also flexible enough, so for example, you do not need to have a transcript. You can add a transcript if you have one, so it has these kinds of flexibilities. So you can kind of make the contents available online, and then it says that the OHMS viewer makes your content visible online, accessible from the archive's chosen content management system. That's exactly the point where kind of my technical knowledge fails me. So there is, I know that there is a lot of technically complicated things involved here. And I'm happy to hear more if here are people who can tell me more how about to deal with these technical problems. Just to mention briefly one of the problems that comes from that plan, there is, of course, a potential conflict between confidentiality and ownership and accessibility. So to make the material available is important for us. But that means that not necessarily all the interviewees have the possibility to remain involved in all the projects that work with their narratives. So there is a potential problem there. But as I said, the future usability of the Archive for Queer Life Stories for students, for educational projects in schools, for journalists, for people who do online podcasts on queer history, for activists who want to work with that material is really important for us. And that's why we try to organize that archive in the way I kind of showed you, to make it available and accessible for education and research and beyond. And this is where I'm going to end, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Benno. This was a very informative presentation again, keeping contact with the audience, which I appraise. And I am sure that among the audience there are questions. Yes, here is a question.
Graham Willett from the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives. A couple of things on oral histories. One is, I might have missed this, but how are they findable by all these researchers out there that will want to use them? The second thing was the comment about not needing transcripts. In fact, the only way we can be sure that the oral histories will be available in 100 years is if they're typed on acid-free paper. So at the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives, we have digitised copies, of course, but we also go through this process of transcribing everything so that no matter how much the technology changes, ink on paper will probably still be around.
Thanks. And hi, Graham. We haven't met yet, have we, over the last 3 days? So the first question was how the researchers would find... I mean, that's why we do all these events. I mean, now we will have the first visiting researcher, actually, in the next academic year, but also kind of, you know, the workshops, the events where I really think, of course, I mean, there is Facebook and Twitter, but for me, it's really meeting people, talking to them and saying, oh, we have that collection, you should try to come and work with it. But we are also trying to... I mean, it's also a question about money. So we are trying in the long term to make funds available to bring people and enable them to work with that material. But that's kind of about the future. So I think it's really, I mean, we go public online so people can find us, of course. It should also, it will also be searchable through the library catalog of the college. And through that, it will be connected through all the larger cataloging systems. But I think in practical terms, it's really often about meeting people and telling them. Transcripts, you're absolutely right. If there is the time, if there is the funds to transcribe, I would always, encourage transcriptions. But I also want to make sure if there is not enough money, not enough time to make it. I know it's a lot of work, so it won't always be possible to have transcription, but then you could still, right, that's the idea with those short summaries, so you still have written word, you can search for certain terms in the summaries, and that still makes it kind of, more accessible and more searchable. Of course, in an ideal world, we would have it all completely transcribed.
Thank you for those resources, especially. That was a great. I had a question about at your institution. Do you have an undergraduate track, and the undergraduates then funnel into this MA?
It's Justin and I, we both also teach undergraduate courses. So I teach one on the history of homosexualities in Germany. I teach broad histories of sexualities Justin teaches a course on capitalism and homosexuality. So the idea is that undergrads can pick those options, and if they are interested, then they can move on, of course, to the MA. So that's kind of the idea.
And is there an interaction between the MAs in queer history and these students who are taking these undergraduate classes? Because that's a phenomenal degree they can get. We don't have an MA in queer history at our school, and I think our students would love to go into that kind of a program, especially if they had an interaction with graduate students.
Absolutely, that happens, and that was in the beginning, that was the hope, but now it has been realized. So, you know, it's primarily the events. So the undergrad students that go to the stuff we teach, then of course we advertise our events. Not all of them, but some of them come. And as you said, you know, people who are interested in queer history usually are engaged, right? And then they're also likely to go to evening events. And then they mingle with the MA students, with the presenters. And, you know, that's a lot of ideas then flow, actually, and start circulating across the college, now also into different departments, as I mentioned, with the media and comms department, for example.
I'll be advertising your program to my students.
Thank you.
I had a question.
Sorry, was somebody else talking?
Okay.
Okay. I had a question. We at the archives had to get some training from the oral histories department at UCLA, and actually we were using a deed of gift when we first started doing oral histories, and they said if you do that, it goes into the archives can use it forever, but the student who does that oral history cannot. So they gave me a form that actually allows the students to forever after have rights to use their own interview. So if they go into an MA program later, or 10 years down the line they get a PhD, they can actually go back and use that interview. So I was just wondering how you developed that form. Was it through a lawyer, or how did you go about that?
It was not. I mean, I had conversations with the oral history people at the British Library and with other people in the field. And kind of that's why we in the end settled for that Creative Commons license, because what you said would exactly be covered by that, because, you know, kind of if people go back to their own interviews after 5 years for non-commercial purposes, it's covered by that, right? And even if it was for commercial purposes, they would have to contact the interviewee and ask for a new permission for that specific purpose. But as long as it's research or anything non-commercial, it's covered by that Creative Commons license.
Lance McCready from University of Toronto. I was wondering if you had a process for thinking through or doing oral history interviews based on who might be left out of the archive. Mm. And which histories have not really been taken up or recorded, and then also thinking about engaging students and thinking that way about queer history.
Thanks a lot. I think our main way of addressing this is by relying on what are the topics our students go for. So if it develops the way I want it to develop, it will be as diverse as a community of our students or their specific interests. So one of the projects in the first year was on black working class nightlife scenes in Newark, New Jersey. And I still hope they haven't ended up in our archive yet, because, I mean, right, there's still negotiations going on. But you know, if we, in the course of time, we have more and more projects on different kind of communities within the broad field of LGBTIQ history, then that diversity will be represented in the archive. If we have funds at our hands to do specific interviews and say, like, there's not enough yet on rural working class lesbians in the 1970s, then of course I would be happy to fund the project directly on that. But I will not prescribe our students I always ask them, what do you want to do? And then they will do that. But so far that has been pretty diverse. So
is that a bad thing to tell us, to maybe engage students in questions around you know, saying what we don't know or what's not in our archive or what, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what we discuss all the time. Mm-hmm. We discuss what does it mean, what do we mean when we say queer, who is usually represented, who is not, what are the power asymmetries that are reflected in our discussion. I mean, that's the whole course is about that. Mm-hmm. But usually our students already come with a lot of awareness about exactly these questions. So when they pick the project, what they kind of really want to research, they usually do exactly what you say. They try to identify those groups, those stories that have so far gone almost or completely unnoticed. Mm-hmm. So, right? I mean, that's what I meant by kind of, to a certain extent, we can rely on exactly that impetus on the side of our students.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The speakers of the next presentation came from Denmark and Sweden. Peter Edaberg came from Copenhagen University. He is an associate professor in the Department of History, Saxo Institute. Signe Bremer is a researcher in the Department of Gender Studies, Lund University, Sweden. The title of their presentation, very interesting, Nordic Queer Revolution, Formations of Homophile, Queer and Trans Activism in Denmark, Norway and Sweden since 1948 until now.
Yes, thank you very much, Judith, for that kind presentation. First, I will talk about 10 minutes about the overall project and my part in it, and then Signe will talk about her part in the project about the trans activism. These kind of conferences are kind of sort of academic speed dating. This presentation will be ridiculously short, but you will see some keywords, you will hear some stuff, you might see something where you think, oh, I'm working with that, or I have an interest in coming about that. Please come to me afterwards, and we can go on a real date talk about if you're working with some of the same stuff, or send me an email after the conference. You can just Google my name. I will pop up. But now to the presentation. Denmark and where I come from, and Scandinavia in general, is quite of a paradox when it comes to queer research. Scandinavia is very progressive in general when it comes to LGBT plus rights and inclusion and integration in society. That is not sort of a massive problem in Denmark, Norway and Sweden, but there's almost no LGBT plus history done. It's very difficult to get funding. Most funds turn you down. People don't see the need for it. They see it as, well, that problem has already been solved. What's there to write about? But, you know, they don't say that about the French Revolution or about, you know, the Napoleonic Wars or whatever. But, you know, they seem to have that. But, of course, they don't say it to me, but it seems to sort of be the idea. So we are overjoyed that we got money from this project from the Swedish Research Council, which is sort of a historical, archive-based, empirically-based exploration of LGBT history in Scandinavia. It's called a Nordic Queer Revolution, Formation of Homophile or Homosexual, Queer and Trans Activism in Denmark, Norway and Sweden, 1948 to 2018. It's a four-year project. Most of us have teaching on the side, and then we have to do research in also as part of our jobs. The researchers are Elisabeth Engebretsen from Norway, who's also present at this conference, who has done a presentation as well on lesbian history. Signe Bremer, who will talk after me, myself, and a Norwegian PhD student yet to be determined. I haven't asked Elisabeth yet if they have hired someone, but her department in Bergen gave us money to sort of get an extra hand, which we are really excited about. We have two senior advisors who have helped enormously to get us this money and to formulate the project. Professor Jens Rydström from Center for Gender Research in Sweden, in Lund, and Professor Tone Hellesund from Norway, who's also present at this conference. What we sort of say, what can we bring to history, apart from sort of saying this is what it was like in Denmark, this is what it was like in Sweden, this is what it was like in Norway. You know, well, maybe you guys are not so interested in that, so what we can bring to the international field are some sort of new methodological angles. We want to make comparative and or transnational studies. We want to show how LGBT history, or what used to be called gay and lesbian history, were not national projects. They did not grow in individual countries as individual flowers growing in each sort of kind of soil. It was ideas, peoples, crossing borders. Ideas flowing in magazine, Der Freund, Der Kreis, Vennen, so forth. And people got this idea and said, we can do some of the same. Gay and lesbian people were traveling and brought ideas home from United States, from Germany, from Switzerland, from Holland to Scandinavia. That is kind of the flow we want to show, that, and we want to write about and show this was not a national project. Because so often we talk about queer history as sort of a national pride project. This is how amazing Denmark was. Aren't we great? Shouldn't you love Denmark? We're number one on the gay countries to visit. And that's all great in some ways, but it's also bad in some other ways. But what we want to show is that these ideas, these people, they flowed over borders, and can we try and show that in the archives? Because we want to sort of not just say that is how it was, we want to show it in the documents in the archives. Most Scandinavian LGBT plus history has been these national stories that I've been talking about, that I'm sure you all know from your own countries, if you're so lucky to have written LGBT history in real books. All these sort of anthology comparisons. Then you have sort of a Scandinavian history, chapter about Sweden, chapter about Norway, chapter about Denmark, hopefully a chapter about Finland, and rarely about Iceland and Greenland and the Faroe Islands. So, you know, but they do kind of the same thing as the national stories. It splits apart what was sort of a mesh and a border crossing phenomenon. We have the luck that each researcher will, to a degree, work and write across all three countries. Mostly Scandinavian people can understand each other, can read each other's languages in Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. So we will all study material in all three countries. So to force ourselves to think transnationally, which is the challenge, because it's easy to say, oh, I want to do transnational history, because that's a buzzword right now in academic history. But we want to force ourselves out of our comfort zone, out of the box, and actually do this. So I'm traveling to Bergen, Oslo, Stockholm, to sort of see if I can actually, you know, get myself into this thinking process. It's also going to be cross-disciplinary. I'm a historian. Elisabeth is a social anthropologist. Sina is an ethnologist. And it's going to be empirically based on a range of different source groups, both oral history and written history, document history. So we're gonna cross a lot of things, you know, queering history. Periodization and thematics. The big national gay and lesbian, bisexual and trans organization in Denmark is called LGBT Denmark. It is sort of the most massive organization in Denmark, and it was founded in 1948 as the League of 1948. It was also the mother organization of the national organizations in Norway and Sweden. Norway and Sweden originally were sort of local branches of Denmark, which was rather funny, but quite quickly they became independent. But it just goes to show sort of this transnational angle that, you know, this was not individual national projects. Organized activity. No, yeah, and we're going to go. So that's why we're starting in 1948, because that's when organized LGBT activism starts in Denmark and in Norway and Sweden. And then, me personally, I think I'm going to focus on the early period and see how far I can get up. Sina and Elisabeth are working more on the later period, and I think maybe try and see how far they can get back. So we sort of work our way from different angles. Organized activism is understudied in a Scandinavian context. Focus has been mostly on either state control, police surveillance of mostly gay men, which I wrote my PhD about, and that's all great. Or it has sort of been on everyday life, anthologies with interviews with mostly gays and lesbians, maybe a few bisexuals. So in between this sort of organized, this sort of this the state level and the individual level, there is sort of the 2 minutes, yes? Great. So then there is the organized activism, and that hasn't really been studied very much in Scandinavia, and that's what we want to look at. I'm going to be focused on the three national organizations and their archives, which have all been turned over to the respective national archives in the three countries. The formation of gay and lesbian and later LGBT activism in those countries. Sine will work on trans activism from the 1970s and onwards. And Elisabeth will work on lesbian activism inside and outside of the male-dominated national organizations. My sub-project is called Interrogating the Scandinavian LGBT plus Movement, Transnational and Comparative Perspectives. First, sort of the big how, what, where, and when question, how did it actually establish itself in the early period? The next sort of sub-project is Goals and Visions and Successes, or when did the politicians start to listen, and what were the premises of that discussion? The third one is diversity and exclusion, remembered and forgotten struggles over inclusivity. I think some of these sub-projects are inspired about the conversations we're having right now in the LGBT movement, and I want to see how did we get to where we are today. They're both sort of the remembered struggle of, were women really included in these big organizations? What about bisexuals? Were they included? What about ethnic minorities? They're also the forgotten struggles in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s about, what about the pedophiles? They used to be part of the big national organizations. They were kicked out in Denmark in 84. That was also a struggle over diversity, but it's one that we rarely want to talk about. But I want to sort of also bring up these sort of forgotten struggles over inclusivity. My goals, a new periodization, forget Stonewall. I don't think Stonewall had that much of an impact in Denmark. The conversation around gays and lesbians changed earlier than Stonewall. Of course, it did have an impact that this sort of new direct action activism, the Gay Liberation Front got an organization in Denmark called Bøssernes Befrielsesfront in 1971. So of course it did have some impact, but not the kind of impact it had in the United States. So I think too often we import periodizations and timelines from America and assume that they neatly fit our European histories, and they don't always do that. Is heteronormativity and homonationalism really the story? Also in Scandinavia, I think this is often also sort of an import of theoretical frameworks that don't necessarily fit a Scandinavian perspective. So that is what I want to ask. Does this actually fit with the sources, with the discussions that were happening in Scandinavia? Why are we always fighting in the LGBT plus movement? I want to sort of show these struggles. I want to show sort of all the arguments. LGBT Denmark was recently split up in a huge sort of debate over inclusivity, and I want to sort of go from there and say, yes, as I said before, I repeat myself, how did we get to where we are today? And then exploring these wonderful archives full of testimonies, full of personal stories, full of minutes from meetings, full of pictures, full of all sorts of stuff that has almost not been looked at in a Scandinavian context. It's going to be so exciting. So thank you very much.
Hi, I'm just going to be very brief about my part of this project. I shall try to mention what I'm going to do because I have not yet started. But it's very nice to be here at ALMS in Berlin. So my project is having the working title Dreaming of Trans Revolutions, Memories, Activism and Meeting Places in the Formations of Scandinavian Trans Rights Movements from the 1970 and onwards. It's a rather big project, so I have struggled quite much about narrowing it down. I have come up with two parts, which I will now just briefly present to you. And I am not used to working with archives. Perhaps I'm rather used with working to compose or collect an archive, but I will also use archival material now. So part one will be this rather concrete project where I will try to map down trans activist organizations and also independent groups from the 1970s and onwards. Who were they? What did they want? Which kind of alliances did they have? What were the relations to the state? What were the dreams? Did they collaborate transnationally? What were the strategies of who were included and excluded in the political struggle, and how have it changed throughout the years? These are questions that I want to ask. And I will work with a mixed research material that will be a transnational multi-sited ethnography, where I will try to interview people who have been working in different kinds of activist groups in both Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. They will represent the organizations and groups and also themselves. I will also look at manifests, flyers, signs, different forms of online material, such as, for example, videos of activist manifestations, which I know there are quite much of, pictures, and archival material from the Norwegian Skeivt-arkiv and also the newly founded Swedish Kurab, who presented the other day about their newly started queer Swedish archive. So this is the first part that also ties into the second part, which is perhaps not as concrete, but I couldn't stop myself from involving it in the project. And when we got funded, I noticed that an artist that is named Sam Hultin, who has worked much with queer narratives in Sweden before, had gotten the personal archive from a Swedish lesbian activist and trans pioneer whose name is Eva-Lisa Bengtsson, and who lived between 1932 and 2018, who gave her personal archive of activism throughout the years to Sam before she died. And so Sam Hultin now works with doing artistic work with this archive. Among other things, Sam Hultin will host a reading of letters that was posted to Eva-Lisa Bengtsson in the 1960s when she started a trans letter club where they were trans people who communicated through letters. And this letter club was called Transvestia, and later on it also evolved into a club, the first trans club in Stockholm, Sweden. And I assume there were not only people coming from Stockholm to this club. And the other part of Samhultin's artistic work will also be a city tour that will be held at Stockholm Pride this year, where Samhultin will guide an audience through Stockholm, through different kinds of spaces that says things about Eva-Lisa Bengtsson's life and the early formation of trans space in Stockholm. And I will partake in those events and try to make some form of autoethnographic account of it, as well as look into the archive itself. I'm not sure how I will write it, but I think it's an interesting way of working. I have discussed with Samhultin, and I was also invited to their home to look at the archive before it was posted to Curab. So this is what I know that I will do. This is the only time I have, I think. So thank you for listening.
Thank you. And I call Benno and Angela and Marie to the stage also. And the audience first has the occasion to ask Peter and Signe. I am not so strict about the time. If these all were very informative and exciting presentations, so okay. If the audience wants to, we can have 10 minutes to discuss.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Jean Treader. I'm with the Treader Collection at the University of Minnesota. And you were talking about research. We have one of the, shall I brag a little, better collections of Scandinavian or GLBT Scandinavian materials, probably outside of Scandinavia. And it does include Iceland, Finland, and we've been working lately on getting more materials from Latvia and Estonia, which we also see as part of the whole Scandinavian group. And Greenland. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to forget Greenland. And my question is, one of the things that a lot of our researchers, and we have quite a few students at the University of Minnesota who are interested in researching their Scandinavian heritage as gays and lesbians, and one of the things that they have found is that the largest influx, at least into Minnesota, of Scandinavians from especially Norway was during the time when the Haganites tried to take over the Lutheran Church in Norway. And I was just wondering if in your research there that you were talking about, if either of you found that to be true, that you lost gay and lesbian population in the Scandinavian countries to Minnesota and other places in the United States because of that change in the Lutheran Church.
But then which year are we in?
Well,
when they immigrated, we are sort of 1860s? Or?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, it was basically around the 18... I think it started in the 1850s. And went up to about 1875, 1880 that they tried. And then naturally the National Church of Norway, which also became the most popular church in Minnesota, took you know, kind of did them in.
Thanks for your question. I'm not an expert yet on Norwegian queer history, but I hope to be to become one. I've never heard that before, and of course also when you are in the 1850s or 60s, there are no one in Scandinavia who would call themselves or understand themselves as homosexual or gay. You know, it's not until the 1890s that people start getting those terms from German sexology and understanding themselves as such. So we would be talking about, you know, sodomites, sodomite criminals. Did they, you know, in the language of that time, right. would they be running away to America? I don't know. So I will have to. I can't give you an answer, but I'm wondering. Who these specific people are, because it would be anachronistic to call them homosexuals, okay. or queer even. They would be seen as criminals at the time.
Okay. They would be seen as criminals. But the other thing that we've found in a lot of the research from our students is that these people were basically farmers, and you know the. Inheritance laws in Scandinavia at the time meant that your farms grew smaller and smaller the more children you had. And so these were like the second, third, fourth, fifth sons that would come to America because they could have much larger farms here. And there are a number of studies that we have of Scandinavian farmers of especially Swedish and Norwegian origin who became lovers and okay. put their farms together. Or
I'd love to hear more about that. You know, that is a wonderful story. You know, if the immigrants, they sort of form these bonds, you know, that's a wonderful Scandinavian, it's a wonderful transnational story that crosses borders. You know, they cross borders and change their lives. So I'd love to know more about it, but I don't know anything about it myself, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just thought maybe you had people that had been studying that and that sort of migration pattern from Scandinavia to the United States.
Yeah, we have that, but not sort of with that specific topic in mind. So I've never heard about it before, unfortunately.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other question? There.
Thanks. Graham Will from the Archives in Australia. Mine was also a question to Peter about the kind of transnational component of combining the Scandinavian countries as a kind of region, and particularly on the idea of forgetting Stonewall. It's just not that important. What I'm interested in is sort of transnational connections outside Scandinavia into the rest of Europe, for example, after 48. I was thinking about Wolfenden in Britain, Arcadie in France, and so on. Will you be looking at those kinds of international connections as well?
Yes, I will. And I'm looking at the correspondence from the early founders of the gay and lesbian movement in Scandinavia. Unfortunately, a lot of it has been burned in order to protect the people involved. But I hope I can unearth some of it and find some of it maybe in the Norwegian archives. Because I know that the Danish organization, which was founded on Midsummer's Eve in 1948, was directly inspired by Der Kreis in the Switzerland and COC in Holland. And also, there's some Paris connection that I can't really figure out. There was a friend in Paris or something. A lot of this can be traced through the magazines. You can see who they are in contact with, and I hope also to find the correspondence in the archives so I can sort of see how this actually developed these contacts, because there were so many contacts in this early period. They were really sort of helping each other all over Europe.
I had a question for Signe. I'm thrilled by that your project and that you're going forward with it. I wondered if you have, if you are the first person to look at that interview. I think her name was Eva. If you were the first person to look at her this way, and if you have. It looked like the interviews, you know, the material has been archived somewhere, et cetera, but are you looking at this for the first time, and do you have any exclusive access to this, because it's a very, very exciting project. Congratulations.
Thank you. I will not have exclusive access to it, since it will be donated to QRAB, the archive. So anyone who will want to explore it will have the access to it later on. I have also met Eva-Lisa Bengtsson once before when I interviewed for another project, and we talked about tensions between mainstream feminism or lesbian feminism and trans activism.
Did you do a primary interview with her?
Yes, I did. but, well, but I don't know anyone who have worked with it before, but I see Sam Hultin as also a researcher. And I really praise Sam Hultin's artistic interpretation of it, and I will do my best to ethically honor it as well. Yeah, thank you for your question.
The other mic is there.
Hello, my name is Rita Pakvalen. I'm working within the culture sector, but I used to be a researcher as well. I'm very intrigued and happy about your project. It sounds really wonderful. In Finland, we've been lately working quite much with queering memory and with connecting researchers and museums and archives and finding ways to bring them together and also to sort of fill the gaps. One of the things that we are also quite concerned about is the absence of trans people within the archives and cultural memory in general. And of course, as a Finn, we also sometimes a lot of Finnish history is very much connected to the Nordic history and the Nordic countries as well, or almost everything we do. And the time period you are researching is a time period where a lot of Finns moved to Sweden, especially a lot of LGBT, not especially, but a lot of LGBT people moved to Sweden to find the freedom. So, and we don't know about it so much. We don't know those stories so much. So it would be really, really nice if when you go through the archives, if you can, when you find archival material of people that moved to Sweden from Finland, that you would sort of tag it and inform researchers in Finland about it. Because, for example, now we were one day ago, or what was it, on Friday, that Elsie Huttinen was presenting a new Nordic project where they are talking about the flow between Finland and Sweden and Iceland and Denmark. And so maybe connect with that project as well, because some people, there was also a flow from Iceland to Denmark, and Iceland is also excluded in your project. So maybe to connect with that project to give the information when you find it, because that would be then valuable for further research, I think. Thank you.
Just a comment. Thank you so much for your comment. And perhaps that would be a research project in itself. Yeah. I'm really sorry that Finland is not included in our project. I have lots of...
But
there are lots of interesting trans scholars in Finland also, and I would love to collaborate.
Yes, and you know, one of the problems was that we wanted to be able to study each in our countries, and of course, I can't read Finnish, so I wouldn't be able to study in Finland. But no, that's not what you're asking. But I sort of already promised Tuula, you know, or sort of implicitly that I would look at if there's something from Finland in the archives I'm going through. I'll tag it, I'll photograph it, and send it to you. The same with Iceland. I'm working with Iris. That so we can sort of help each other unearthing this, because there are massive archives to go through, and we need to sort of do this together and collaborate with these things. So I'm definitely hearing you, and we will do that, or I will do that.
I think this will be the last question. Sorry, we are out of time. You can ask the presenters individually after the session.
As a quick question.
the Transletter collection you were talking about, I forgot the name of it, was it also a letter network so that individuals could send photographs of themselves to each other to share looks?
I'm not sure, but probably photographs were included in the communication. I guess that it's quite common, but I don't know, but it will be apparent when I look into the archive. But I think it mostly is letters, but I assume there are also photographs. And for anyone who wants, you can just Google at Samhultin, and Samhultin, and you can just read more about this project. It's called Eva-Lisa Bengtsson's Monument. So there's also information in English. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I think this was a great session. Thank you for the presenters and the audience also. I have two official communications.